Extinction. The Track Record. Take Karl Marx, 1818 to 1883, who argued for struggle in the economic field just as Darwin had argued for struggle in the natural world. As Augusto Zimmermann said of Marx, Marx believed that the existence of God had been disproved by the inexorable forces of science, reason, and progress. As such, Darwinism became an important element of Marx's theory. As his close friend and co-writer Friedrich Engels pointed out, just as Darwin discovered the law of evolution in organic nature, so Marx discovered the law of evolution in human history. In a personal letter to him, Marx actually reveals that Darwin's Origin of Species was indeed very important, as it had provided him with the basis in natural science for the class struggle in history. As a sign of gratitude, Marx sent Darwin the second German edition of Das Kapital. On the title page, he inscribed Mr. Charles Darwin, on the part of his sincere admirer, signed Karl Marx, London, 16th of June, 1873. Take Friedrich Nietzsche, 1844 to 1900. As R.J. Hollingdale put it, Darwin had shown that the higher animals and man could have evolved in just the way they did, entirely by fortuitous variations in individuals. Natural selection was for Nietzsche essentially evolution free from every metaphysical implication. In his The Gay Science, 1882, and again in his Thus Spoke Zarathustra, 1883 to 1891, Nietzsche boldly declared that God is dead. He did not shirk the inevitable consequence. He was convinced that taking pity on another is not good. Showing pity, Christian pity in particular, is deplorable, a fatal weakness, a mark of degeneration, a hallmark of a slave mentality. The evolutionary principle demands self-interest above all. Nihilism becomes an important concept for the late Nietzsche. He anticipated a crisis that will follow the gradual decline of Christianity. That all moral values, such as altruism, humility, compassion, are null and void, is the fallout of this crisis. Take his Twilight of the Idols, 1888. Self-interest is worth as much as the person who has it. It can be worth a great deal, and it can be unworthy and contemptible. Every individual may be scrutinized to see whether he represents the ascending or the descending line of life. Having made that decision, one has a canon for the worth of his self-interest. If he represents the ascending line, then his worth is indeed extraordinary. And for the sake of life as a whole, which takes a step farther through him, the care for his preservation and for the creation of the best conditions for him may even be extreme. Take his The Antichrist, 1895. Christianity is called the religion of pity. Pity stands opposed to the tonic emotions which heighten our vitality. It has a depressing effect. We are deprived of strength when we feel pity. The loss of strength which suffering as such inflicts on life is still further increased and multiplied by pity. Pity makes suffering contagious. Under certain circumstances, it may engender a total loss of life and vitality out of all proportion to the magnitude of the cause. Pity is to be deplored because pity preserves things that are ripe for decline. It defends things that have been disowned and condemned by life, and it gives a depressive and questionable character to life itself by keeping alive an abundance of failures of every type. People have dared to call pity a virtue, and as if this were not enough, It has been made the virtue, the basis and source of all virtues. Pity is the practice of nihilism. To repeat, this depressive and contagious instinct crosses those instincts which aim at the preservation of life and at the enhancement of its value. It multiplies misery and conserves all that is miserable, and is thus a prime instrument of the advancement of decadence. Pity persuades men to nothingness. In short, according to Nietzsche, working on the principles of evolution, to show pity is odious. Because of the benefits of the survival of the fittest, we should glory in the extinction of the weakest. Francis Galton, 1822 to 1911. Here is the abstract of an article in French by D. Aubert Marston. Not only was Sir Francis Galton a famous geographer and statistician, he also invented eugenics in 1883. Eugenics, defined as the science of improving racial stock, was developed from a new hereditary theory conceived by Galton himself and from the evolution theory of Charles Darwin, transposed to human society by Herbert Spencer. Galton's eugenics was a program to artificially produce a better human race through regulating marriage and thus procreation. Galton put particular emphasis on positive eugenics, aimed at encouraging the physically and mentally superior members of the population to choose partners with similar traits. In 1904, he presented his ideas in front of a vast audience of physicians and scientists in London. His widely publicized lecture served as the starting point for the development of eugenic groups in Europe and the United States during the first half of the 20th century. Take H.G. Wells, 1866 to 1946. As Jerry Bergman said, after being exposed to Darwinism in school, H.G. Wells converted from devout Christian to devout Darwinist and spent the rest of his life proselytizing for Darwin and eugenics. Wells advocated a level of eugenics that was even more extreme than Hitler's when his time came. The weak should be killed by the strong, having no pity and less benevolence. The diseased, deformed, and insane, together with those swarms of blacks and brown and dirty white and yellow people, will have to go in order to create a scientific utopia. He envisaged a time when all crime would be punished by death because people who cannot live happily and freely in the world without spoiling the lives of others are better out of it. He was hailed as an apostle of optimism, but died an infinitely frustrated and broken man, concluding that mankind was ultimately doomed and that its prospect is not salvation, but extinction. Despite all the hopes in science, the end must be darkness still. Wells' life abundantly illustrates the bankruptcy of consistently applied Darwinism. Winston Spencer Churchill, 1874 to 1965, bought heavily into eugenics. As Martin Gilbert said, he, Churchill, wrote to the Prime Minister, H.H. Asquith, in December 1910, about the multiplication of the unfit that constituted a very terrible danger to the race. Until the public accepted the need for sterilization, Churchill argued, the feeble-minded would have to be kept in custodial care, segregated both from the world and the opposite sex. In his letter, Churchill told Asquith, the unnatural and increasingly rapid growth of the feeble-minded and insane classes, coupled, as it is, with a steady restriction among all the thrifty, energetic, and superior stocks, constitutes a national and race danger which it is impossible to exaggerate. I am convinced that the multiplication of the feeble-minded, which is proceeding now at an artificial rate, unchecked by any of the old restraints of nature, and actually fostered by civilized conditions, is a terrible danger to the race. Concerned by the high cost of forced segregation, Churchill preferred compulsory sterilization to confinement, describing sterilization as a simple surgical operation so the inferior could be permitted freely in the world without causing much inconvenience to others. In February 1911, Churchill spoke in the House of Commons about the need to introduce compulsory labor camps for mental defectives. As for tramps and wastrels, he said, there ought to be proper labor colonies where they could be sent for considerable periods and made to realize their duty to the state. Convicted criminals would be sent to these labor colonies if they were judged feeble-minded on medical grounds. It was estimated that some 20,000 convicted criminals would be included in this plan. To his Home Office advisers, with whom he was then drafting what would later become the Mental Deficiency Bill, Churchill proposed that anyone who was convicted of any second criminal offence could, on the direction of the Home Secretary, be officially declared criminally feeble-minded and made to undergo a medical inquiry. If the inquiry endorsed the declaration of feeble-mindedness, the person could then be detained in a labor colony for as long as was considered a suitable period. The Eugenics Record Office, ERO, in Cold Spring Harbor, New York, established by the Carnegie Institution of Washington's Station for Experimental Evolution, was founded by Charles Benedict Davenport, 1866 to 1944. And directed by Harry H. Loughlin, 1880 to 1943. It was a research institute which from 1910 to 1938 gathered biological and social information about the American population. Its mission was to collect substantial information on the ancestry of the American population, to produce propaganda that was made to fuel the eugenics movement and to promote the idea of race betterment. As the ERO website makes clear, eugenics was and continues to be a controversial issue due to the pressure radical eugenicists put on the government to pass legislation that would restrict the liberties of the people who had traits that could be considered undesirable. Specifically, the ERO dedicated its resources to the restriction of immigrants and the forced sterilization of individuals with undesirable characteristics. They promoted their ideas through the distribution of propaganda that came in the form of images and information packets. All was not plain sailing, however. Something else that caused tension within and surrounding the ERO was Harry H. Loughlin's radical policy suggestions. He was known for presenting fraudulent evidence to support policies of forced sterilization and was known for dogmatism. And many could not live with the stark consequences of their belief. Furthermore, the rise of Nazism in the 1930s and their use of and belief in eugenics led to large criticism and the ultimate closing of the ERO and their practices. Nevertheless, as the wave of new adherence to the eugenic cause increased, the movement took on an almost religious or spiritual character. Charles Davenport, director of the Eugenics Record Office, came to realize the need for a canon or dogma for the movement and developed the eugenics creed. The creed underwent some minor modifications over time, but it remained the central doctrine of the eugenics crusade. Enter George Price, 1922 to 1975. This is what Michael Regnier wrote about Price. It was altruistic ants that posed a particular problem for Charles Darwin. Natural selection is often described as survival of the fittest, where fitness means how successful an individual is at reproducing. If one individual has a trait that gives them a fitness advantage, they will tend to have more offspring than the others. Because the advantage is likely to be passed on to their offspring, that trait will then spread through the population. A fundamental part of this idea is that individuals are competing for the resources they need to reproduce, and fitness includes anything that helps an individual reproduce more than the competition. But, as Darwin observed, ants and other social insects are not in competition. They are cooperative, to the extent that worker ants are sterile, and so have literally zero fitness. They ought to be extinct. Yet there they are in every generation, sacrificing their own reproductive ambitions to serve the fertile queen and her drones. Darwin suggested that competition between groups of ants, queen, drones, and workers together, might be driving natural selection in this case. What was good for a nest competing against other nests would then outweigh what was good for any individual ant. Group selection, as this idea was known, was not a very good solution, though. It didn't explain how the cooperative behavior evolved in the first place. The first altruistic ant would have been at such a huge disadvantage compared to the rest of its group that it would never have got the chance to breed more altruistic ants. The same was true of humans. Natural selection was intrinsically stacked against any altruistic individual surviving long enough to pass on their altruism. This left a rather embarrassing paradox. The evolution of altruism was impossible, yet clearly altruism had evolved. If the biologists couldn't resolve this, would they have to throw out the whole idea of natural selection? Luckily, a young man called Bill Hamilton spared biology's blushes with a slightly different solution in 1964. He proposed that altruism could have evolved within family groups. Yes, an individual altruist would seem to be at a disadvantage, but that was not the whole picture, because other individuals who shared the same genes associated with altruism would all influence each other's inclusive fitness. Discussions of human altruism are often framed in terms of someone drowning in a pond. Do you put your own life at risk to try and save them? If you do, that's altruism. Hamilton's idea, which became known as kin selection, acknowledge that compared to a selfish person who never got their feet wet, someone who went around jumping into ponds to save drowning people would be at a greater risk of dying before they managed to reproduce and pass their altruistic genes on to their children. However, if they happened to save a relative who shared the same genes, our altruist would have indirectly helped to get those genes passed on to the next generation after all. If the total benefit derived from having altruistic genes in the family, so to speak, was greater than the cost, then the evolution of altruism was no longer paradoxical. When George Price stumbled across Hamilton's work in the Senate House Library in 1968, he was shocked. He was forced to confront the relationship between morality and family, the biological imperative he should have felt to sacrifice his selfish ambitions in favor of supporting his kin. He immediately set to work to challenge, even disprove, Hamilton's theory. But he could only confirm it. Along the way, he derived his equation of natural selection, which helped to prove that altruism was not selfless and moral, but rather selfish and genetic. One of the aforementioned W. D. Hamilton, 1936-2000, just this. The ultimate criterion which determines whether a gene G will spread is not whether the behavior is to the benefit of the behavior, but whether it is to the benefit of the gene G. With altruism, this will happen only if the affected individual is a relative of the altruist, therefore having an increased chance of carrying the gene. Nathalie Angier expressed it thus. Dr. Hamilton recast the concept of fitness, that is, an individual's success in reproducing, to incorporate the survival and reproductive success of the creature's close relatives, hence the term inclusive fitness. In so doing, he merged Darwin's focus on individual animals competing for the privilege of siring the next generation with Mendel's studies of how distinct genetic traits are transmitted over time. The idea can be roughly understood by one biologist remark in a pub that he would gladly die for two brothers, four cousins, or eight second cousins, but not for just one brother, or for anybody else less fit than himself, I would add. Each of them carrying the requisite percentage of the individual's genes to compensate for the mortal deed. George C. Williams, 1926-2010, with his Adaptation and Natural Selection, 1966, popularized Hamilton's theory. Richard Dawkins, born 1941, with his The Selfish Gene of 1976, built on Williams' work. Do not miss the title. Think of abortion on demand, which is now being carried out on an industrial scale. In total, there were 194,668 abortions notified as taking place in England and Wales in 2017. Termination is being fashioned into a tool of the new eugenics, under which we not only have the right to have a baby, regardless of our life circumstances and the type of assistance required, that is, gestational carriers, to obtain our entitlement, but also a right to the baby we want. Where does this come from? Listen to this. These articles on the abortions and eugenics website are concerned with two separate but related things. The eugenics roots of the pro-abortion movement and the connection between modern legalized abortion and the specter of eugenics. Margaret Sanger was a pioneer of legalized abortion and the founder of Planned Parenthood, the largest provider of abortions in the U.S. Sanger was also a well-known eugenicist whose writings make clear the historic connection between abortion on demand and eugenic thinking. In short, this kind of thinking, this kind of talk, this kind of behavior towards the unborn child is only possible where Darwin's tree of death is thought to explain and, above all, to justify everything. Whatever the metaphysics, the message is clear. Evolution can only be essentially self-centered. Violence is rooted in the genes. Violence, struggle for survival and reproduction of the fittest, is inevitable and unstoppable. Lee Allen Duggettin summarized it thus. One of the central dogmas of modern behavioral ecology is that blood kinship plays a critical role in understanding the evolution of social behavior, particularly of costly social behavior, such as altruism and cooperation. But it was not always so, and what I would like to do in this Perspectives is provide some historical context that led up to William Hamilton's seminal work developing inclusive fitness theory. The story begins, not surprisingly, with Charles Darwin.